Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us.
Hello, TSF family, and welcome to episode 19 of season 7 of This Spiritual Fix. Today, we are going to be talking about retrograding your inner villains. In other words, how to integrate, invert, and thus get the best gifts out of your own inner villains and move through your arcs. Enjoy.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation.
Mama.
Past life regression.
This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltse.
Hello, Anna.
Hey, Christina. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
We are on the eve or the precipice of you hitting your own winter break.
Yes. I mean, I'm going camping tomorrow, so like I have like 3 hours or so before I have to now gear up for a camping trip, but I'm going to really enjoy those 3 hours of winter break prior to going camping.
Oh, you guys are leaving when? Tomorrow?
Tomorrow morning at like 5 a.m. We go to a place on the Georgia coast that has no cell service, no cars. You have to take a ferry there. It's amazing. And we did it last year. We did it last year and it was amazing. Like I really appreciated it. I didn't want to go. I was like, why would I want to camp in the winter? That sounds awful. And then I went there and I was like, oh my God, I really need this around this time of year.
But didn't you only bring like one sleeping mattress or something?
We did. This time I actually bought my kids really nice like memory foam sleeping pads. And so my husband didn't want one. And so my kids and I, we have these really nice memory foam, and that's great.
Nice. Yeah. Well, right after getting off the phone with my next patient, I actually have a Hanukkah party tonight, which I did not even plan this party.
You didn't even plan for it.
Everyone who was like, hey, when's the Hanukkah party this year? I told everyone, we're not doing it this year because I just hosted 30 people for Thanksgiving and it went great and it was lovely, but like I'm a little bit kitchened out. And so, but my son, he made a negotiation with me. If he got X, Y, and Z done for school, could he have an impromptu Hanukkah party? So I literally sent out the invitations Wednesday. We're recording this on Friday. And I still have to go to the store and get one more thing. And then I have to make a bunch of stuff and then fry a bunch of latkes and then host 10 children. And then I have to pack because tomorrow morning we're heading to go try skiing for a couple days in North Carolina. They've never gone skiing. So we're going to give it a shot and see how it goes.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh. They've never tried skiing. That's like, you know, I tried to do the whole like skiing later when I was in college. And it's like one of the, you know how sometimes you have like 5 stories in your life that you kind of keep telling over and over again because they're just like so epic. My one time of trying to ski when I was in college is one of my 5 stories, which I'm not going to tell right now. I'm going to leave everybody in
How
suspense.
Have I not heard it?
Well, no, it was like me who likes to like know the beginning ways of how you do something and like the most basic ways of how you do a new skill, especially because I am a little bit uncoordinated physically. Like once I learn how to do something, I'm great. And like once I've been trained how to do it, I can do it so well. But in those beginning stages, like don't get me to a choreography class. I'll just be like, I'll look like that really awkward person who just like cannot get it. But if I go to it 10 times and you do all the same moves, I'll look decent. I mean, I'm not going to say I'm looking great. And so my friends convinced me to to go to a hill in Pennsylvania. We were in Pittsburgh. I went to school in Pittsburgh, and like we went to like a local, you know, ski resort, and they were like, "Oh yeah, we'll teach you. It'll be all good. We'll teach you." And so I borrowed my friend's parents, like her dad's ski suit, and you know, rented the skis and did all that kind of stuff. And it was this pivotal moment of watching and being like, "Oh, so can we go to the bunny hill first, you know, with a little pull, like you pull yourself up and you learn and you're with all the kids." And my friend looks at me and she's like, "No, we're just going to go up to the top of the hill. We're just going to go up to the top of the hill." And I was like, "But I don't know how to ski. Like I don't know how to ski."
Oh my gosh.
And so we literally go up to the top of the hill and she just says, "Pizza and French fries. You'll get it." And I'm literally like, "What the fuck? Like, I don't know how to pizza and French fries." So the whole morning was spent with me getting up to a really high speed, not knowing how to stop, and just having to sit down to stop over and to the point where I like actually busted open my friend's parent, like her dad's like vintage snowsuit, because I sat down so many times because I did not know how to ski. And so I like went up once. Like after doing this like twice, I was like, "This is ridiculous. Like, I don't know how to ski. Pizza and French fries is not going to do it. I like don't know how to do this." So I go up to the top and I'm like, "Shit, I have to get down now." But I just like sat in the ski lodge and I had some hot chocolate and I was just like, you know, I had my split open pants and I'm just like, "It's going to be okay." So the last run of the day, they finally come and get me and they're like, "We're leaving." And I'm like, "Great. Now I have to somehow ski down this hill." I was like, "I'll just like sit down. It'll be fine. Like I'll do whatever." And of course, at the end of the day, like it's really icy on, you know, it's like it turns from snow into ice by that point, right? And so I'm like trying to go down the most basic hill. And it culminates in me, like all the different runs go into the same massive area. And I'm sitting here trying to, you know, I am an uncontrolled skier going down this hill, just doing my best on ice to do anything. And as I'm going down, I collide with a child. And I literally am going down the hill on my back. I pick up the child to protect them. So I'm like protecting them as I'm like going down the hill on my back. Like my skis have come off. I'm just like literally with this like young child. I'm trying to protect this child from like
my... They're like, "Kidnapper."
I'm literally running down the... I'm like sliding down this icy hill with this kid on my stomach. And when I finally did, I like let the kid go. And it looks at me with the most terrified look on its face. Like, what the, like, who are you?
Why did you grab me?
Oh my God. And so I had to like go back and get, I had to like climb up this icy hill and go get my skis that had fallen off. It's a wonder that neither of us got hurt, and I ended up literally just like trying to walk, like butt slide with these open ski pants down the rest of this hill. And it was like, So whenever anybody's like skiing, I'm like, yeah, do that early for your kids so that they can understand their bodily awareness and maybe give them lessons. And that's a great idea.
Yes, that's what we're doing.
Nice. That sounds really fun. I kind of hijacked your moment of your weekend.
No, I was just saying that like my winter break begins, but like my winter break doesn't really begin until I guess tomorrow.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You want to hear something funny related to the day? It's the 19th of December when we're recording this, and today is my mom's death anniversary. And when I woke up this morning, I always wake up with a song, and I always pay attention to the song that's in my head when I wake up, because it either means it's like my meditation, if you want to say, is I get a song from my guides and I'm like, this is a song. I've talked about this on the podcast before. And it was so funny because this morning the song was a song from the movie, from the TV show Smash, and it's called Don't Forget Me. And it's the song at the end of it. The whole Smash show is about Broadway and about making a Broadway show about Marilyn Monroe. And this is the song that they wrote at the very end, is this like Hail Mary to save the show, because they had ended with her death. And they were like, no, we have to have this like lovely, like, and the song's called Don't Forget Me. And so I'm sitting here hearing this song in my head being like, it's like, and don't forget me. It's like this really nice thing of like, you know, saying don't forget me. And I'm like, who's telling me this? I don't understand. Who's saying don't forget me? And I'm literally like going through all my guides. I'm going through all these other things that have happened this week. I'm like, who gave me this song? And I'm like 15 minutes into my morning and I'm like, oh, it's my mom's death anniversary. And she literally just, I start hearing her laugh in the back of my head, just being like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. She wouldn't have said that, but you know, no shit, Sherlock. Do you think that maybe I gave you that song today? Sometimes we can be dumb. Anyway.
I love that.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to have to listen to the song after we record.
It's just a nice little, like, again, it's like, it's very Broadway-y, like, oh, we're having our culminating moment at the end, even though I've just died of an overdose.
Is that what she died of? Oh, yeah, she did.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I forgot. Not your mom, Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. 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 That's the thought. That's the thought. So what are we talking about today, Anna?
Okay, so what we're talking about today, as we have been talking about for the last, I don't even know how many episodes, 16 or 15 episodes.
Something like that, yeah.
We've been talking about the villains. But when we first started talking about the villains, I was pretty much as in the dark as our listeners. So I was learning as we went. And now that I've gotten this far with it, and as our listeners have gotten this far with it, I want to go through the medicine for each villain one more time. And it might be a little redundant for some who got it right away, but like it's taken me a long time to really get these villains. And it makes total sense. Like now when I see the villains in real life or in a movie or in a book, I'm like, this 100% tracks. And then like thematically everything tracks. And it's wonderful. It's like a really useful tool. But what I want again is to revisit what exactly is the medicine and what is it look like in a practical sense? Because I feel like the first times we went through it all, it was very abstract, especially to me. So anyways.
So just to kind of give you guys an understanding of the process, because it's all well and good to be like, just like with any of these systems where you're like, oh, I'm a type 7. Isn't that amazing? And this is what happens when I'm at stress. And this is what happens when I'm whatever. Or the human design, like this is my human design. And you know, Anna was the one that you were the one who opened me up to the world of astrology and being like, oh my God, can I actually like lessen the degree of severity that some of these astrological placements can have in my life? Like the idea that you can remediate something that you're stuck, you know, that you were born with is a really vast concept, right? Is that talked about a lot in astrology out of curiosity?
I don't think so.
No, right? It's like, this is what
I am. It's more just like, this is what you are versus this is the spectrum of what you could be.
Right, right. And that's the idea that we're trying to go into. We've talked about that forever, of this idea of like, there's nothing to fix, get rid of, purge, get out of you. It's all about how do you express the most loving version of something that you already are. Right. And so inversion was years ago, I was doing a bunch of work and they told me told me a principle that I've used in everything that I do, which is that invert yourself every single day. There's a physical inversion that you can do every single day, which helps with your health, but there's also a psychological, mental, emotional inversion that you can do every single day to change up your perspective. Right. And so that was when I first ran the Inner Villain cohort a couple of years ago, that was the principle. That was the main processing tool. It's expanded from there, but it all kind of, you know, whether, like I said, it's retrograde, like kind of changing the spin of, or inverting as in like flipping, both of them imply a different polarity. You are approaching this villain and these villainous traits with the idea of, I don't need to be stuck in the same way of doing things. And if I can invert the polarity, if I can change the spin, if I can do something that's totally unpredictable for this, I can move through this arc and I'll find that I'm not stuck, which is what we always talk about. Stuck is actually the greatest enemy of any kind of spiritual intelligence, is when you're stuck in a single position and you don't have the fluidity of movement to be able to understand that different things are needed for different times, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. So first, Anna, do you want to go first?
Well, I don't know if there's a going first to it or just like a conversation about it. We could talk, I guess, first is the obedient critic. We've talked about that a lot. And the hero is the anarchist. So being against the rules that you've created, right?
Yep.
And then the legend version is the equalizer.
Right. So the way that I think of the obedient critic is that if the obedient critic is all about belonging, and if you've experienced a lack of belonging in your life, whether because you didn't have the right credentials, so you kind of othered yourself because of that, which is a very common one with this, or if you feel that you just don't belong, like you feel like the black sheep of your family, or you feel like you can't follow the rules and guidelines that everybody else has, and you find yourself in a very strict hierarchy, usually of your own making or something that you've inherited. So a lot of military families find themselves in the obedient critic arc, but also a lot of families that have very strict cultural rules about what is acceptable for jobs and for, you know, cultural practices. They find themselves a lot in this arc. And so the anarchist is the hero of this arc, because the idea is that you're supposed to break down all the walls that you have inherited so that you can then rebuild them in your own, in a way that works better for you. And maybe you're not rebuilding them as walls. Maybe you're rebuilding them as boundaries, right? That move between different things, in which you understand that it's appropriate that, yes, you're going to go back into your family, and you can see the hierarchy in which everyone exists. You can choose to try and invert your family by being an anarchist and being like, I don't care about your rules. But most of the time, it's about belonging to yourself and not trying to necessarily change everyone around you.
And I think for medicine, at least for me, when I played with this one, it was about figuring out what the hierarchy scale was that I was prescribing to my own world, and then doing the exact opposite. So for me, being intelligent, being competent, and being resourceful were like my religion, my hierarchy. That's what made me worthy, right? And so I had to go through a period of a few weeks where I deliberately did the opposite. I deliberately made myself incompetent and full of terrible ideas and acted stupid. And my family still loved me for it. And then they got more equal because of it. They were able then to rise up and solve their own problems. So I equalized it by lowering myself in the hierarchy.
Yeah, so brilliant.
That was a tool. What's another tool someone could practically apply?
So one of the things that I love is I recently heard, and I don't know if I mentioned this here. I recently heard that hosts are DOMs. Like we think of hosting as, dominant and submissive, that the best hosts are dominant and they fully embrace the role of being dominant. Like if you have a submissive host, you're never going to know what you're supposed to do, right? You're going to be like, am I supposed to do this? Am I supposed to do that? Right? Like, you know, we've kind of mentioned this in the past. And so the equalizer is the legend, because they understand power dynamics, because this arc has so much to do with power dynamics, right? And like who has the power, the person who has the most credentials or that has the most in the hierarchy has the most power. And so if you are the equalizer and you want to, if you want to move into the heroic form of this, you move past the anarchist into the equalizer, and the equalizer is like, I'm going to play with power dynamics right now. Like I'm not going to, you know, I recently talked to a client this week and they were like, I hate hierarchy. I hate that. Cause they've been stuck in the anarchist for a very long time. Right. And they're like, I hate it. I don't want to use it. I'm like, dude, you are so good at power dynamics and you don't use that tool. Why are you not using that as a tool? Because, you know, he was submitting and wanting to make everybody happy and falling into the people pleaser. And I just talked to him a couple hours ago and he was like, I'm in charge. I was like, you bet your ass you are, because you're the visionary and you're the one who needs to do it. And it was like, he became the equalizer in that moment. He recognized he no longer wanted to submit to somebody else's power dynamic. He no longer wanted to do whatever. He's not keeping the power dynamic because of his ego, which would be a stuck place. He's using the power dynamic as a way to forward the vision and what he wants to do with his company. Right. And it's like when you can take a tool that you used to have to submit to, and all of a sudden you become, you know, you become an expert at it and you wield it in beautiful places and wonderful ways, like that is the true equalizer, right? And so shifting around power dynamics of just like in your relationship, I do this in my relationship now, of just this like, oh, you're going to get that done, aren't you? And they're like, yeah, I'm going to get that done. And then you flip it the next day, the other person's dominant, right? And it just becomes this really amazing play of, I'm not stuck low on the hierarchy, I can move. I can move to be the dominant person. I can move to be the submissive person. And I can move with power dynamics in a very different way.
Very interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go to number two, the vengeful martyr.
Yep.
So the vengeful martyr, you want to give a summary of what they look like?
Yeah. The vengeful martyr has a lot of, if we use our seed analogy, the vengeful martyr is the one who is growing and trying to support everything based entirely on their own energy, getting very little help from other people, oftentimes because of an abandonment wound in which they are trying to become indispensable to those around them. They are the helper in the Enneagram, and they are the undefined sacral center in human design. And so the vengeful martyr, their ultimate lesson is about the hero form is the self-possessed or the selfish. Selfish obviously has a kind of pejorative term, but that's, you know, this idea of you need to understand where you stop and other people begin. You need to maintain that boundary, right? Because hopefully you've learned boundaries from kind of understanding, or you're borrowing that from the obedient critic as your experience. And then you are pulling in other help, which is what you borrow from the vein controller. I don't know if that's confusing, Anna, in the way that I'm saying it, but the idea being that the selfish has to understand where they stop and other people begin, and they need to maintain that boundary between themselves and others. And they fully invert this by asking for help and accepting help fully.
Yes, and it might not even be asking for help. I think it can be pooling resources.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was going to say, in my own experience with this, resources, you keep telling me your medicine is resource, your medicine is resources. And I've been using it. Like, I really wanted to go to this gym class, but I had to get my older child to the bus at this time, same time the class starts. Well, I just asked my husband to do it, which to anyone else might be like, well, duh, just ask the other parent to take the kid to the bus. But like, I had this block that like, I'm the parent who takes my kid to the bus every morning because I am the best at it. I'm the best at getting everyone ready and tracking everyone's schedule. And it will be just too complicated to explain, but like, it's not. I just asked my husband the night before, hey, really want to go to this gym class. Would you be willing to wake up? Because he doesn't wake up at that time. Would you be willing to wake up at this time and make sure, you know, and he's like, absolutely. He'd love to do it, but I always do it because I want to be the most competent. Anyways, that's one example. Another example is TaskRabbit. I started pooling my resources to use this app called TaskRabbit, where you can hire people to do all the things that you don't know how to do. It's amazing. Anyways.
Yep.
Yes. So yep. Pool resources, not, and then also just recognizing the times that you make yourself obsolete. Like, why am I making myself the only person who knows how to do this? Why am I the only person who knows how to turn the dishwasher on? Like, why, you know, like,
continually be making yourself obsolete, right? Like, continually be making it so that everybody knows how to do that and everyone is upskilled to be able to help. And we so often want to make ourselves the only one who can do something, right? You want to make yourself indispensable. And by making yourself indispensable, you then make it so that you never have an opportunity to rest, and you don't understand how to rest, right? And so the more that you use resources in whatever way, and you recognize that you need to drink while you pour, that's how you can invert the vengeful martyr in particular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Vein controller.
The vein controller. The vein controller is the one who is concerned with status and is an extremely hard worker and would like, and their whole universe is about resources, right? Like, that's kind of like, if you think of it as the medicine of the villain before is the concentration of the next villain, right? So the vein controller's concentration is about resources and about developing trust. And so the inversion of the vein controller is the unveiled, because one of the hardest things for a vein controller to do is to appear that they can't, that they don't have it all under control, and to appear that they are vulnerable or have some sort of weakness. That is a really difficult thing for the vein controller. So in order to invert that, you become the unveiled. And in order to move even further past that, what you do is you, the legend of this arc is the inventor. And the reason it's the inventor is because if you've gone to a point where you not only have a mastery over resources, your job is to use those resources to create something in the world that you want to see happen, right? It's not just about doing what, you know, is a facade, like a status, something that creates status. It's like you want to use those resources to create something new. So you borrow the tool from the Eternal Child, which is that creative chaos, and that's what becomes the inventor.
I like it. Okay. And yeah, and then just like a practical one is when I was playing around with this, when you would just say, go confess your vulnerability to the person, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if you felt like you had been a mean girl, or that you had, so, you know, been an, you know, a like I call it a politician or an influencer. Like if you felt like you had been like judgmental of another person, you're just like, hey, this is the reason why I'm judgmental. Like, this is the reason I felt like this, right? I felt like being judgmental because I'm actually like really concerned that, you know, say that you're really concerned about, you know, appearing like you're not doing a lot of work. And so then you say, hey, I was just judgmental of how much they're working because I feel really self-conscious right now that I'm not able to put my all into how much I'm working because I do have a lot of things pulling me in a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important move through that. So yeah, mm-hmm. That's the vein controller inversion.
All right, here we go. Eternal Child.
Eternal Child, the four, is the Eternal Child is all about growth and how do you become self-reflective. And it's, you know, it's Peter Pan in the movie Hook when he literally, if anybody knows that movie, one of my favorite movies, and he like looks in the water and he's become self-reflective. He understands and integrates himself so that he's ready to move out into the world. And so the Eternal Child has this really entitlement in its worst forms and abundance in its best forms. And so in order to invert the Eternal Child within your life, especially if you have someone who always wants to be taken care of, loves to love bomb, loves to kind of, you know, want people to look after them all the time, is to have them be self-reflective. That is the hero of this arc, the inversion of this arc. And that can look like mirror work, which we've never talked about on this podcast, Anna. Have we talked about mirror work? Have you ever done mirror work?
We've never, I think we've had a guest talk about it, but that's it.
But that's it. I was like, isn't that funny? Like, why have we never, it's such a common way for people to do shadow work is to do mirror work.
I've never really done it. Have you done it?
No, but I'm interested in it because it sits right in this one. It sits in the vein control, the Eternal Child, and the Hungry Shapeshifter. It kind of sits in all those as like a tool that could be used by all three. But the one of the best things that the Eternal Child can do to invert is to look at themselves in the mirror and recognize that they are not always the victim.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So imagine the Eternal Child in your life saying, my job has been to say, how did I do something wrong in this situation?
Right.
Could I have been at fault in this situation?
Right. Well, it's interesting you talk about that. I'm reading this really, really good book called The Choice. Have you read it? Uh-uh. By Dr. Edith Eva Egger. Mm-hmm. And she was a Auschwitz survivor. Like, her life story is incredible. She survived Auschwitz. She was in a pile of dead bodies. They thought she was dead because she weighed like 60 pounds and they threw her in a pile of dead bodies with everyone else. And then the U.S. liberators came and this guy came up to the pile of dead bodies. He's like, if anyone in here is alive, wiggle your fingers. And she had to muster all her strength and she wiggled her fingers and he saw her and he was like sweating, getting all the bodies off her. And she lived. Anyways, she tells her whole life story and the book is called The Choice. And she talks about how life is always going to give you the opportunity to suffer, but you always have a choice with what you're going to do with that situation. And so she talks about how everything in life was a choice. And she says that victimhood comes from the belief that you don't have choices. Yes. And one of the most important things you can do in life when you feel like a victim is do a proper inventory of what choices you have available to you. And I'm wondering if because the Peter Pan who likes to play the victim the most, they live in this world of delusion. I wonder if because of their delusion, they've somehow like blinders up of what their choices actually are, because they're living in this delusionary world where reality is this one way and they're completely oblivious to all the choices available. But that phrase, you know, victimhood comes from a belief that you do not have choices, made me wonder how could I apply this to all the villains, because ultimately all villains come from a belief that you don't have a choice, like you're locked in. Like, I'm locked into being the vengeful martyr because I don't have any other choice of how to do things. I don't have the choice to use resources. I don't have resources, but like I do. And so I feel like so much of this work, especially for the eternal child more than anyone, is to recognize what choices do you have available, right?
Yes, I think that's a brilliant way of saying it. It's one of the things that I love more than anything is how the scathing moral inventory, which is the fourth step in the 12-step programs, is 100% also to the fourth villain. Right? Like they totally match up, because a scathing moral inventory is exactly what an eternal child needs to do in order to be able to like recognize who they are. And the fact that they don't see a choice is a reminiscent of a childlike state, right? In which you, a child doesn't have choices, but they're supposed to grow out of that state. Right? You know, like a child doesn't have the capacity to sometimes, you know, it's like, oh, I would love for my child to be emotionally intelligent and be able to like not have a temper tantrum right now. It's like, guess what? They don't have access to that yet, right? They don't have a choice. But as they grow up, they're meant to be, to develop that form of emotional intelligence. And thus they start to have choices. They have more and more choices as they grow up. And if you choose to stay arrested in a state of no choice, then you can't, you're going to stay a child, right? And if anything, that's maybe the greatest definition of childhood is the lack of choice, right?
Yeah.
So that's really good. And so the hero is the reflective and the legend is the traveler. And the reason that the traveler is the legend is because the traveler, to get into a state, and Anna and I have talked about this a lot on the podcast, but to get into the state of being a traveler, whether you're traveling through realms within yourself or realms that exist. And so the eternal child can borrow discernment and regulation because that is needed to travel from the evasive expert, which we'll talk about next.
Awesome. Okay. Tell me about the evasive expert, please.
Yes. The evasive expert is, I think of it as the soil. It's the balance. It's the universe of balance. It's all about, the theme is about balance between the emotional and the intellect. And people who are out of balance in this way are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They have Dr. Jekyll being incredibly intellectual and very like, I know everything. And then they have this Mr. Hyde that's going to go and murder people at night sort of thing. That's a stronger version of it. But, you know, it's a great metaphor for this one in particular. And the medicine, the hero, the inversion of this one is the passionate. And the reason it's the passionate is because you have to start to integrate your feeling into what it is that you're doing. You have to stop and feel. I almost wanted the hero of this one to not be the passionate, but to be the slow, right? Because sometimes slowing down or the Joker, which is what they borrow from which is what they can borrow. Like the more that you are slow and can like take yourself not as seriously and get out of your mind and feel, that's how you invert this one in particular, which means that you have to come to terms with what it is that you've done and what it is that you've suppressed.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say the medicine is kinesthetic, somatic therapies, right?
I would say that. And I would say just, honestly, like for me, having gone through all this stuff with the mold, and being straight in the middle of the evasive expert, the best medicine that I had was, I said the acronym before, I'll say it again. It's funny. It's free, meaning I have plenty of time to feel. I'm united. I'm doing it with my partner. I'm not dividing and conquering. I'm nuanced, meaning that not everything is black and white. I'm natural, meaning that I'm spending as much time as I can in nature. I'm spending as much time as I can embodied as possible. And you is the why. It doesn't, maybe there's a better you, why. But you know, that's funny. And everything has to be funny. If you've lost your sense of humor, you are back in the villainous aspect of the evasive expert.
Yes. Oh, that reminds me. I pranked my son the other day. And I laughed so hard I cried. And then we did the same prank to my other child and then my husband. And we all laughed so hard we cried. And then we pranked Megan's son. And Megan laughed so hard. It was just like, so like, I forgot how healing and important laughter is. Like, we laugh a little bit, we joke a little bit, but we were like laughing, crying, laughing. Like, that one little thing brought so much joy into our house, remembering just how healing it is to just belly laugh with somebody. It was hilarious. We just...
What was the prank?
The prank was, he saw my email and he noticed that the principal sent a newsletter. And he's like, what's that? And I'm like, oh, the principal sends a newsletter every week. I just never told you because, you know, I just didn't think you were interested. And the newsletters are like, you know, school's out this week, you know, there's a canned food drive, whatever. But what I did is I went into Canva and I made a fake newsletter and it said my son's name smells like peanut butter. And he doesn't even eat peanut butter. And it had like, you know, ipsum lorem, like fake text. And then I put in like something fake school fundraiser. Like, I made it look real, but like the headline was about my son smelling like peanut butter. And he was like, what is this? And I said, I was like, yeah. And then I showed my other kid and I'm like, can you believe that Dr. Miller sent this out? And my other kid's like, what? Like, everyone was so confused. And then Megan took it a next step and she showed her son and I had changed it to have her son's name. And she's like, I need to call the principal. This is just not right. Why are they sending this to all the parents? And her son was like, what? When they knew it was a prank, they all laughed. Like, oh, it's just dumb.
That is so good. I feel like that works really well with the divisive immortal because, like, especially with things that could feel scary and unsafe, and then you borrow from the hungry shapeshifter the humor of it and like the movement of attention. That's brilliant. So to finish off the evasive expert, the legend is the integrator. The integrator can move. They can hold complexity inside of them. They're intellectual, but they're also not taking themselves so seriously, and they're feeling things when they need to feel. They're able to slow down enough to be able to feel whenever they need to feel, and they have times in which their passion is able to be seen by everyone around them who loves them, and not just a certain group of people or not just like a certain area, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
All right, Divisive Immortal. Can we get a summary?
Yes, Divisive Immortal is the 6 in the Enneagram. It is the undefined splenic center in human design. And it is the, and I know I'm doing this inconsistently, but there is a whole bunch in the show notes that we'll put that kind of summarizes this, of what their human design and Enneagram components are. The Divisive Immortal struggles with community and belonging and safety. And so when you have a divisive immortal, they could be extremely risk averse, and they're also usually extremely loyal. They are going on a spectrum of loyal to the pack, like faithful to the point of detriment, right? Your divisive immortal is going to be the most likely to join a cult, right? And so, or to completely shelter their children to the point where they're never allowed out of the house. The hero of the arc is death. Because the more that you can go through a death process and ego death process, address your fear of death, all of that, whatever it's saying is, it's like a deep one, but it's like, if you're trying to preserve life and like you're trying to keep everything safe and protect everything so much to the point where you're not seeing things for the way that they really are, your job is to address that fear head on. So basically death, because death is people's biggest fear, the hero and how you invert this is you dive headfirst into your fear. Because there's a lot about fear in this one.
It reminds me, in the Dhammapada, there's a whole section where Buddha tells people, go to the burning ghats, which is where in India they burn the dead bodies. And he's like, go to the burning ghats and look at the different levels of decomposition of the human body. Mm-hmm. And I want you to look at those dead bodies and say, that's my body. Like, that flesh is my flesh. We're like such a death-averse culture, right? Whereas in India, they parade the dead bodies through the street. They're on the burning ghats. Like, you can see dead bodies, you know. You can see hundreds in a day if you go to Varanasi, right? So you don't even have to do death processing. You could look at dead bodies. Mm-hmm. I guess that's like a little bit crazy to say, but if someone has this villain and that, like, and you are too far removed from death and you want to do a death process or even see the dead bodies, there's that bodies exhibit.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? You could go see the bodies exhibit and you could look at those bodies in different, they're not in different levels of decay, but they're in different layers of anatomy.
I think that there's a lot of other cultures that actually are very, like, we even have some cultures in America, religions in America have wakes because we still recognize that there's some value in seeing bodies.
Death, seeing death, right? Yeah.
Seeing death. And that's where, in what Anna's talking about of like the Buddha being like, imagine that you are the body, the dead body, that's borrowing from the hungry shapeshifter. You're shapeshifting into something that's already dead. Right. You know, and that is like a huge part of the tool of inversion of what it means to get through this one. I worked with somebody who did a divisive immortal work, and it was like the most fucking brilliant thing I've ever seen. It was just like, she just dove straight in. She's like, death, you know, cause she'd been sheltered her whole life. Mm-hmm. Right. And her, and like to the point where, you know, her parents would close the blinds and be like, you never know when the perverts are going to be looking in and things like that. Like, she was not allowed to do anything for her whole life, despite the fact that she, you know, she grew up with this origin villain, but she never embodied it. It was just conditioned in her. And so when I was like, you got to do a death process, she did a death process, and it was like all the lights turned back on inside of her. It was the most incredible thing to witness.
Awesome.
Truly. It was, ugh. It was so good. And so the legend is the healer. I find that everybody who has this as a villain are often ends up being in the healing arts, whether they are touching somebody or doing whatever they are. They're doing something in the healing arts, whether they're a photographer and like their photography is healing, whatever it is. So they're able to move through and embrace people through death, birth, and the whole life of things.
I love that. Okay.
Hungry shapeshifter.
Oh, okay. This one's so cute. By the way, all the people I know with this one are really cute. Okay, keep going.
This is the one I'm trying to cultivate at the moment.
What do you mean?
This is my arc that I've chosen. Like, this is my 2026 arc that I've chosen as the Hungry Shapeshifter. Right? Because I am obsessed with time. I love being present. And I love the practice of being present and kind of the movement of time. And I also have always had this thing where I've wanted attention, right? Like, why do I have two podcasts and like three channels? And like, you know, there's a part of me that like loves to perform and be in attention. So how can I use that? How can I use that for the betterment of not just myself, but also to amplify other voices and perspectives? So the Hungry Shifter does that. They're in time. They are oftentimes borrowing many different identities, whereas the eternal child is kind of trying to figure out their identity by looking in the mirror. The hungry shapeshifter's got like 10 identities that they're switching between all the time. And so the hero of this is the present, because time is a huge part in this one. The present says, can I be here now? And can I be fully present where I don't actually have to be the center of attention, but I am the center of my own attention? Right. I don't need to pull in all these other focuses of attention onto myself. I'm actually just going to be present here and now. And that's how you invert this one. It's one of the ways you can invert this one.
I love that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
I was going to say, so what kind of meditation techniques would be help people who have attention deficit stuff going on?
What I would say is, you know, that Raja technique, which is like my fucking favorite. Oh my God. It's so good. And I can give it to anybody and it just like immediately quiets their mind. It's a Raja yoga technique that I learned when I was in India. And if you are looking forward, I may have mentioned on the podcast in the past, it's been so long, I can't remember at this point. But like you look forward, you close your eyes and your job is to, slowly turn your head. When I mean slowly, I'm talking, it may take 5 to 10 minutes for you to turn your head from looking straight forward to looking over your left shoulder. Okay. And you're all of your concentration is to moving as slowly as you possibly can. and it immediately quiets the mind. It gives the mind something to focus on because it's doing something still. And it, you know, it's like, it's still doing something. It's not doing something still. It's trying to remain active. And all of a sudden it focuses the mind on the present moment, like almost nothing, no other meditation that I know when I teach people first right off the bat does. Like really slow. I'm talking like you can't even like sense, you know, it's like those rotating restaurants, you know, in which you're like, is the rotating restaurant actually moving? It's like, yes, it is, but very, very slowly, because otherwise people will throw up.
Very cool. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. The Fabricator is the legend of this because they have taken all of those different identities and made a single one from it. They've welded them all together and created something new.
Yeah. I love
it. Yeah. So now the Righteous Bully.
I know a lot about this one.
Do you want to tell us the overview of
this? No, you tell it. You tell it.
All right. The Righteous Bully's overview is that they are all about opinion because it's the Ajna Center in human design, undefined Ajna Center. They're the 8 in the Enneagram. And the Righteous Bully is about wanting to fix people, having a really strong opinion about it, wanting to be a leader and kind of protect a large group of people, kind of maybe sometimes has a savior complex, thinks that they're the one who can fix everything. That's very classic Righteous Bully. And so the hero of this arc is the surrendered, because what you're doing is you're taking in the, you're letting other people lead and you're letting a bigger group of people lead. And you're also recognizing that people are on their own healing paths and it is not your job to fix anybody else. If they ask for help, that's one thing, but you're not supposed to just be like, well, but I figured this out. I thought about this for hours and I know the best way that you can heal from this.
I think here, a lot like the Eternal Child, the choice is very important. Like recognizing you have a choice, like you can choose to be a righteous bully mm-hmm. and you can choose not to be one. Because I feel like a lot of us who are righteous bullies, when we get locked into it, we're like, this is the only way. This is the only way. Like I have to fight. I have to fight for my opinion. I have to fight for this way of being. I have to prove my point. It's the only way. And you get like tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. So recognizing you have a choice. You have a choice to maintain the friendship, maintain the relationship. You have a choice to bite your tongue. You have a choice to wait until you're calm to explain your point of view. And I think that choice comes from recognizing that you're being a righteous bully, which is the surrender piece, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the legend of this arc is the channeler, because ultimately righteous bullies are channeling an aspect of higher self, or they could be channeling their hurt parts. They could be channeling all over. We can channel anything. And so when it's in its detriment, you are channeling the not your opinion. And when it's when you're the channeler, you're kind of opening yourself up to the universe. Or something that's greater, but you're not enforcing it and forcing people and like stuffing it down people's throats, right? Because you've inverted it. You've surrendered and recognized that you may not have all the answers. You may have an answer and maybe that's your job, but to say that answer, but that's not the only answer there will ever be. Yep. And so the level up tool from the nothing, which is the invisible destroyer, their next one up is non-attachment and letting go, which I think is a really great one, right? Like, it's like the righteous bully needs to let go a little bit, right? They need to borrow some from the invisible destroyer.
Yes. All right, let's do number 9, the last one, the invisible destroyer.
The invisible destroyer. The overview of the invisible destroyer is the nothing. Addiction sits on this arc. So does the stagnation, depression kind of sits here, or depersonalization, like this idea that, you know, you really bad luck sits on this arc too. I've noticed when people who are invisible destroyers usually have a tendency to have very bad luck, and things just kind of break around them. And,
that is hilarious.
Yeah. It's a really weird thing.
But it's true.
It's so true, isn't it? I literally was just like, I used to always go away because my husband has some invisible destroyer in him. And when I used to go away from home and I wasn't here, like my force wasn't here. My husband would like accidentally break everything. And I would just be like, what the fuck is going on? And then I was like, and then they told me, they're like, it's because it's the invisible destroyer. Like he's just doing something because he has to do it. He doesn't really want to do it. He's like, he's questioning it. He's like deep in that. And because of that, bad luck just kind of, I mean, that's the Invisible Destroyer is bad luck, right?
It's like, I can think of people and like, their what's it called is always breaking. And then this is always breaking. And then it's just, yeah.
And there's, and that could be Eternal Child in some ways too, because it's like, oh, how can I be the victim of everything breaking in my life? But yeah, I really appreciate that. So the Invisible Destroyer, their hero of the Invisible Destroyer is the Embodied. And the Embodied is going to experience pleasure, because one of the best ways to invert this is to experience pleasure in the body, since for the most part, IDs experience a lot of displeasure in the body and they find a lot of pain in the body, and that they are questioning their desire to be in a body. And so therefore, the more that you can bring pleasure to the body, the better, which is why the hero is the Embodied. And the Legend is the Architect, and the Architect is the one who doesn't just destroy, but also creates, understands. Like, you can't be an architect if you don't clear some ground first. You have to destroy in order to be able to create. You have to embrace both of them. And that's why the Architect is the Legend of this arc. And the level up tool is borrowing from the beginning of the thing, which is the One, which is the Obedient Critic, which is structure and containment, because an architect is able to structure and, you know, is able to contain creation and also contain destruction so that it doesn't run rampant in their lives.
I love that. So they need structure. Mm-hmm. Maybe. And then how does that look in real life?
How does that look in real life? Honestly, whenever I know that somebody's in the nothing, because the nothing is like the pinnacle, in a lot of ways is like the pinnacle villain, because it has combinations of all the ones before. As I say, is there a lower number that you can address, right? So with the Invisible Destroyer in our family, we address it through the Evasive Expert. So the practical thing is like, somatic, sensual work, feeling, seeing if you can like bring feelings into conversations more, seeing if you can slow down. It's a little bit of an open book in this. It's a little bit of like a like you can choose a lot of things to help with this one. Like, but I think practically finding your passion and really like understanding what that is, and you stop asking questions and you stop ruminating and you get out of your head as much as you possibly can, using nature, using pleasure, using whatever you can to get in your body. That is the most practical thing you can do for an ID.
Okay. And then just to reiterate, when you say lower number, what you're talking about is that the Invisible Destroyer is made up of two villains, the Evasive Expert and the
Divisive Immortal.
Okay. Divisive Immortal. And then the Righteous Bully is made up of Obedient Critic and Vengeful Martyr.
Yep.
I know that one.
Yep.
The Hungry Shapeshifter is made out of the Vain Controller and the Eternal Child.
Exactly.
And then none of the other ones are fusions, right?
No, just those
okay.
three.
Those yeah. three. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for structuring all this, my projector friend.
Obedient criticism is good for something. All right.
All right.
See you later. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Spiritual Fix. If you are interested in finding out what your primary inner villain is, you can go to www.christinawiltse.com to take the test that is linked. That's KristinaWiltse.com. Thanks, y'all. And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Hi y'all, Christina from TSF here, The Spiritual Fix. I wanted to invite you to my Substack, where we are about to start a series on the inner villains, the parts of us that sabotage, control, or quietly hide when things get hard. These upcoming posts will walk you through how to recognize them, work with them, and eventually transform them. They're going to be a wonderful complement to what we're hearing here on TSF. And if you are a paid subscriber, you'll also get a new meditation each month to support that integration. You can find it all at ChristinaWiltse.substack.com or search The Life Alchemist. Thanks, y'all.